It's The Wonky Show. We're talking Mickey Mouse courses, international students, complaints, and the big reset at number 10. It's all coming up.
It might be okay if you're an 18-year-old and you've got, you know, sufficient funds that it doesn't matter where you study and you don't need to rely on a part-time job and you haven't got caring responsibilities. But obviously, there is a real diversity in students' experience and what they need to be successful at university. So I think there's that angle too in terms of the...
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, reporting from Wonky's Buzzing HQ, also known as my spare room. And here to help me unpeel the higher education policy onion this week, I have three brilliant guests. Later you'll hear from Public First, Jonathan Simons. And here in the virtual studio, I have Selina Bolingbroke, a fellow at the Halpin Partnership. Selina, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Mark. I think my highlight was actually at the end of last week, where I was in the company of 6,000 other guests at the first online KindFest digital festival with five different tents of kindness thoughts in terms of different parts of your life, finishing up with a live rendition of the Milkman of Human Kindness by Billy Bragg. There was nothing that was going to beat that.
It looked amazing. I thought Private Eye's write-up was a bit miserly. It did look like an absolutely fantastic event. Credit to everyone who put that together. And we have Paul Inman, PVC International at the University of Reading. Paul, your highlight of the week, please.
Yeah, hi, Mark. I'm in my other life, I'm Chair of Trustees of Photo Oxford, which is an international photography festival that the city holds. And we managed to hold a festival in lockdown, well, in lockdown and in lockdown plus. So the fact that we even got to the end of it. So we had a meeting with trustees last night, and not smug, but the fact that we actually got a festival online and it with events in the city was a tremendous achievement, and all without Arts Council funding.
Fantastic. And we're just looking at how to do Wonkfest in a similar context. It's going to be different. Right. We begin this week with the question of quality and value. We've had a glut of reports. First of all, OFS released a consultation about this, and UK put out a big statement. Selina, what is going on?
Well, the consultation is really, I suppose, seen as attempts to balance two recent ministerial agendas, that of addressing low quality courses and removing bureaucratic burden. The consultation is open until the 12th of January, and there is a real focus on the quality of student outcomes as expressed in metrics on continuation, completion and progression. There was also this week a parallel announcement from Universities UK of the establishment of an advisory group to develop a statement of intent with a view to eventually having a charter that clarified and codified the way universities review and improve their own provision. Sort of predictably, the way it's been covered in the press has really focused on the spectre of the Mickey Mouse course, and there's been plenty up on the Wonky site this week looking at it from different perspectives in terms of how we might define a poor quality or low value course to what the UUK proposals might look like.
You mentioned the Mickey Mouse courses. I mean, it almost looked like that was what the lines that had been briefed from the regulator, the press. I mean, it was Mickey Mouse courses all over the newspapers the other day, which is always a really grim experience for people that work in higher education, because, you know, I don't think anyone's going to be claiming to run a so-called Mickey Mouse course. And just the whole idea is kind of laden with a kind of sense of condemnation. I mean, we all know the kind of courses the Telegraph don't like. I mean, Paul, are you running any Mickey Mouse courses at Reading?
Yeah, we'd like to have a little line on our website that we don't run Mickey Mouse courses. I mean, over the years, because my background is as a television producer and film director, and ran a couple of skill set screen academies in other universities, I just never engaged with that dialogue. And I regularly was phoned up by journalists, mostly from the Telegraph, wanting to talk about Mickey Mouse courses. I mean, if you don't engage with it, I always think it will go away. I mean, in television and journalism in particular, it was quite difficult because, you know, going back in my career, like 25 years, there weren't that many really good journalists who come out of a course that was run for kind of media studies or student. But over the years, of course, there are now, if you look in the host of journalists, really good journalists, and they came out of that wave of those type of courses. So I always just smile smugly and think, you know, this is just a non-starter in terms of a discussion.
Mm. But there is a drive from government, isn't there, Selena, to crack down on low value courses. And I think a fair interpretation might be that this is an attempt by OFS to operationalize that to some extent, and this focus on outcomes really is kind of the only way of doing that. But it's kind of fraught with problems, isn't it? I mean, there's all sorts of unintended consequences of regulating in this way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this, as Paul said, this is not a new move in any way. This is actually quite a tired old narrative,
a tale as old as time.
Yeah, and I think the other thing around it is that, you know, largely this is again a government solving perception problems rather than real ones. So actually, if we look at what's happening now this term from a student perspective, I think, you know, that there probably are some real issues of both quality and value in terms of their student experience. There is nothing here from OFS that would deal with any of these problems in real time. And so often is the case with our sector. Whenever we think about metrics and data, they are looking in the rearview mirror. There is very little data that is used in a way to deal with problems that are in real time happening. And, you know, the other thing that I think about this is that if there was a really serious concern about, a number of courses that were failing students, what's happened to the, you know, subject level TEF? That was supposed to be a way to really get behind the granularity that was needed at subject level. Now, I'm not been a fan of the subject level TEF, but, you know, it seems again that there is the policy initiative that kind of works in concept, but once they try to work that through, the technicalities of how they would measure that, how they would use the metrics, what time span they would do that within, is what then scuppers the operation of it. Hmm. And I think the other thing to say is, you know, the sector has long signed up and had QAA, and in particular the quality code.
What's happened to QAA? There's not a mention of it.
Not a mention. I mean, it's absolutely conspicuous by absence, and one can't help feeling that there is still some, you know, that's political, and you know, that relationship is yet to be really resolved, because I think most people within the sector, and certainly from an academic quality perspective, have got much more confidence of the way in which the quality code deals with the complexity around the quality of the student experience and academic outcomes than these kind of habitual, every 2 years, a new kind of policy initiative that seems to come from government via the OFS, which deals with ministerial concerns rather than deals with student concerns.
I really like the dance that goes on, though. The dance that happens where you get the announcement and then you try and get another announcement out by UUK, just to so there's that, there is, it is a literally a dance, as and it's about autonomy. It's about autonomous institute. You know, are we autonomous? You know, do we have, are we independent? Well, on one day it seems to suit government that we are, the next it's not. And it's that dance backwards and forwards as we try to self-regulate and have regulation forced upon us.
We saw a similar dance last week with admissions, with everyone trying to outdo each other on PQA.
That was probably one of the best, because that involved multiple players as well, wasn't it? I mean, the idea of UCAS getting out a comment before UUK, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I just thought, yeah, it is fascinating, but also tiring.
Tiring, and as we'll talk about later on the show, potentially some concerning signs about the direction number 10 might go in, and the sorts of policies they might pursue, which are kind of firmly in this ballpark. Okay, and as Selena says, we've been covering this extensively on the site all week, and there are links in the show notes for our detailed commentary and analysis about what's going on. Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Natalie Day here from Sheffield Hallam. I'm the head of policy and strategy there. I've got a piece in Wonky this week, which is about how governments and universities could join forces to avoid a retention crisis. They're basically arguing that we need to make policymakers aware of how much is at stake if indeed we do have a retention crisis. and really making the case that we need to work more effectively together, because increased numbers of students dropping out of university into a particularly painful labour market will really have significant consequences for them as individuals, but also making the case that it has the consequences for society at large. That increased attrition will, you know, really does result in wasted potential, wasted learning and wasted opportunity, for which we'd all pay a really steep price. So it's important that governments and universities do sort of work together on a more joint approach around sort of a common purpose, around a commitment to consistency and clarity, and around really working out a new mode of working together to cope with this increasing uncertainty that we're all working with in order to avoid a retention crisis.
I'm Dr. Michelle Morgan, and I'm a student experience transition specialist. I'm currently a higher education consultant, but prior to that, I was associate professor, associate dean at a post-92 university. In the last week, government has provided universities with guidance on how to get our students home, and there has been the announcement that a vaccine will soon be available. This has understandably injected hope across the nation that by the spring, we may be able to resume some sort of normality, whatever that will mean for society and higher education. However, we know that the bulk of our students will not be a priority for the vaccine, meaning that COVID-19 will continue to have impact in halls of residence, on our campuses and in towns and cities, regardless of the gigantic efforts made by universities. Yet there is little strategic national level discussion about what we do in January when students resume their studies and when we expect the arrival of the next tranche of new undergraduate and postgraduate students. The start of the term is only 8 weeks away. So my piece this week talks about why we need to plan for January now and the top five action points we need to address if we are to resume study safely and support our students and staff.
Next up, IDP Connect has released global polling of 5,000 international applicants, offer holders and students about their plans for next year. Paul, talk us through that.
Yeah, sure. This is, again, the research that, that was released this morning is by IDP Connect. Poll of over 5,000 international students drawn, you have to say, from their applicants, offer holders and students, primarily in India and primarily postgraduate students. And what they're, what we're looking at, or what that, that research is looking at, is will they come? It's essentially, will international students go to the, their destinations of choice? And it looks at the UK, the US, and then Southern Hemisphere, New Zealand and Australia. But it's showing that there's basically, I don't think anything that's there is that surprising. 80% of those asked intend to start their studies as planned. This is looking forward to January. And there's been, this is an increased number since they did the last, I think the April 2020 and the June 2020. They've been tracking what international students are thinking of doing. And I remember, wrapped up in this is also, you know, there are all sorts of things that, that are wrapped up in that around when people say what they're going to do and what they actually do. But I mean, it's a positive sign in lots of ways. Willingness, increasing willingness to study online, as long as it's a transition to face-to-face teaching, a tolerance of online learning that wasn't there before, and an acceptance of quarantine has been something that happens within a pandemic. So, I mean, I just thought it was kind of interesting, but sort of didn't tell me anything I didn't know already.
Hmm. Is it, sort of, is it backing up what you're seeing in your own institution?
Yeah, I think actually, if you look at anecdotally, although, I mean, it's backed up with data as well, what we're seeing, I think the interesting thing is this, it really had a lot of the stuff that IDP Connect come, it's a preponderance of Indian students in the sample. So one always has to look at that. But I mean, if you think of what's happening in China for us, Chinese students are continuing to arrive to study at Henley Business School at University of Reading, and they're arriving weekly, and because they're arriving from a very, what they regard as a very safe place to travel to the UK, which is less safe. But we, the thing that's for us, we've noted is that they are arriving; they just continue to arrive.
I mean, some of the data is interesting. The overall response, or the perception of the UK's response to the coronavirus, is bad. That's not a big surprise. But we come out ahead against America. Do you think there is? America has seen a dramatic fall off of international students this year, and Canada too. I mean, they're essentially closed. Do you think we're going to see a bit of a boost overall this year, despite the challenges, because of these other markets essentially faring worse and shutting down harder?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that. I'm, you know, the type of job I've got, I am, you know, not innocent and not ignorant. I am eternally optimistic. And I do see when I'm traveling around the world, especially in South Asia and Southeast Asia, students who want to come to the UK because of the quality of the education. Sometimes we don't do ourselves any favours because of the various mess that we've been put into by government policy over the last 5 or 6 years. But I know there's the desire to travel to the UK and because of what was happening under President Trump in the US and then the Chinese kind of Australian tiff, then that's played out in our favour. So one has to be thankful for small mercies at the moment.
Mm. Biden could reverse that trend though, couldn't he?
I'm still, Mark. I think I've heard you talk on one of the other podcasts. Let's celebrate what happened in the US last week. I'm not in the position to sort of start pulling that one to bits yet.
I'll take that. It's good news. Sorry,
I was just going to say, but I think the thing is actually, and this is the thing that goes through my mind in terms of the American question is, you know, once confidence of populations have been lost, it's very difficult to bring them back. And actually, we all know that the response to the pandemic can be led by government, but it can't be completed by government. And I think we've experienced on a much more minor scale something similar here since the Cummings-Barnard Castle episode. But the other thing is that just in terms of business more generally, you know, recovery has never been about actually just the ability to open up. And I think it's much the same in this study here in terms of the feedback from international applicants. Recovery is about consumer confidence. And I think those countries that are focused on that will see recovery much, much quicker than those that have simply relied on the kind of regulatory controls as to whether some, you know, a business is allowed to open. And I think we've got to bear that in mind, the nature of kind of consumer confidence and the feelings of psychological safety and care when we think about how we give international applicants confidence that we will continue to be a safe place with a high quality student experience in the future.
Yeah, and if you look in the research, it's one of the bits that the UK does better in is that sort of better than the Southern Hemisphere, really, is that we seem to be viewed as having better or at least having less restrictive travel policies in place than what's going on in particular in Australia and New Zealand at the moment. But the other thing, sort of odd thing in there, is that the only thing that the US seemed to do sort of better on or well at was the increased consumer confidence in the economy, the shape of the economy, which I looked at. I couldn't quite make out that.
Maybe it's relative. the particular problem, isn't there, Paul, around the end of this year? And I'm just interested. I genuinely don't know what's going to happen here because we've obviously got the student travel window coming up and the mass testing regime spinning up at campuses everywhere. But there are particular problems, aren't there, for international students, like, for example, the lateral flow tests, which a lot of airlines don't accept as kind of okay for fit to fly. So I guess I'm interested to generally know how you're working on that at Reading and how we should be getting international students home and then back again at the end of this year and the start of next.
Yeah. I mean, it is a problem. It's I've literally come from an early morning sort of breakfast meeting about particularly this. Of course, a lot of the UK government guidance sort of avoided a conversation with international students. I mean, you could say that was that was okay. I mean, I don't think it was okay. In fact, when it talked about, it seemed to be addressing anybody that was going overseas. It didn't say winter skiing holidays, but it felt like it was talking to home students about should they wish to travel overseas. Obviously, if you've got international students here, they may wish to go home at Christmas. I mean, at University of Reading, one of the things we're realising is that there will be more students staying over at Christmas. We normally have around about 1,000 students who stay in our facilities over Christmas anyway. We're reckoning that number is going to be higher because students will choose to stay here rather than go away and come back for obvious reasons, not just about what happens at this end as they leave in the UK, but their own country going back in and then coming out again. So I think that's going to be one of the main things. And then universities that rely on large January entry that's going to be also be a challenge. You're right around the lateral flow test. That's been brought in, this mass testing regime that's been brought in so quickly. You can see that on the hour, people are trying to make sense of all the supplementary questions that come out of it. And I'm expecting some more guidance from government and within the university over the next couple of days.
Hello, Jim from the team here. We've got another wonky at home event coming up on Student Experience 4.0. COVID-19 has sharpened the focus on universities' engagement with digital technology. The great online pivot early in the pandemic sparked plenty of innovation and showed universities just what's possible. But it's also exposed some of the gaps in universities' digital capabilities. The student experience of the future may not be wholly conducted online, but it will be digitally enabled at every stage. The campus of the future might not exist solely in the cloud, but it will be smart. And the future university won't be staffed by bots, but students' interactions with academics and professional staff will be underpinned by emerging digital technologies. So at our event, in partnership with Salesforce.org, we'll assess the parameters of the next normal for universities, how digital technology will shape and enhance the student experience in the future, and we'll explore what universities can do now to get ahead of the curve. That's Wonky at Home, Student Experience 4.0, preparing for the next normal. Full details on how to get hold of your tickets, as ever, at wonky.com/events.
Right, the Office for the Independent Adjudicator has released a briefing note on course and provider closure, as well as its perspective on the sensational closure of GSM London last year. Selena, talk us through it.
Yeah, two briefing notes from OIA, and as you say, Mark, the sensational closure of GSM. They are very helpful briefing notes. I think there's obviously kind of the sort of salutary lessons, I think, in terms of OIA's own anticipation that there will be other closures ahead of us, whether that be courses or campuses or whole organisations, institutions. And then, you know, that's the kind of lessons to be learnt report. And I think some of the headlines in terms of what should be done in those situations to best protect students will not be a surprise. What is a surprise is that these are not routinely followed because of the existence of student protection plans. So some of the issues that they raise actually wouldn't necessarily be reflected in an agreed university SPP. I think the other report that they've done, which is a much closer reflection on the experience of GSM, which is a small private provider, around 3,000 students based in London, OIA actually said that they were very glad to have been including on the task force that gathered when the closure was happening. But one of the reasons that they state is that it absolutely focused minds on doing the right thing and kept student concerns at the forefront of people's minds. Now, presumably, there won't always be a task force. There won't always be a representative from the sector complaint body to sit there and focus minds on doing the right things. But I think it's a... It carries a number of case studies around different students, their complaints, and how the OIA suggested the institution should respond to those complaints. And in quite a few cases, there was a recommendation of some level of financial compensation or tuition fee refund. But those students are the unsecured creditors. Now, anyone who's ever been in a situation of liquidation will know that unsecured creditors rarely get 100% of the money that they're owed. And I couldn't help but think there's almost another report to be written here, another briefing note, which is what happened next in the stories of those students. GSM was well known for taking, you know, very much a WP cohort of students, and you know, it's largely mature. I just kept thinking, you know, it's a very tough thing when you've gone through this situation again, just sort of emotionally. It will have taken a lot of investment, not just financial investment, for these students to have started their courses, never mind gone through the trauma of closure and transfer to another institution. And I'm sure there will be some success stories that come out of that. But I think the point is that, you know, there is no amount of compensation, financial compensation, that is ever really going to really, you know, deal with the level of upset and trauma from a student perspective. And I think, you know, the point really should be that there has to be much, much stronger protections for institutions in terms of not getting into this place. Now, I think we know that one of the tensions has always been, should the Office for Students raise concerns about finances at a point at which it may well send the institution that is financially fragile into a much stronger, you know, downward curve. But I think, you know, if it is the Office for Students, then to me, the onus of responsibility is in doing what is best by students. Again, there is some blogs now on the Wonky site. Jim Dickinson has done a good one that is published on Thursday morning. And actually, one of the things, I'll quote from Jim's article, but he says this, you know, arguably the most important thing you can do in any kind of crisis review is to ask yourself whether it can happen again. And I think, you know, having read this, the conclusion would be, yes, all of this could happen again. But, you know, this was just a small private provider with 3,000 students. I think the real worry is this could happen again at some scale.
Fascinating. There's a lot here, and a lot jumped out at me from this report. I think, Sina, you're so right that we've got to see a final part to this report tracking what happened to these students. I think that's going to be really critical for the sector's learning. It seems to me that obviously the OI has got this year very much in mind, because we've obviously got institutions in some financial trouble, and we've also got quite a lot of changes to what was promised in terms of the student experience because of COVID, naturally. A couple of things jumped out to me about that, though. So Paul, I mean, one of the things was the responsibility for the validating partner. So, you know, where you've got a relationship with a college, I mean, the OIA suggests, or some other institution, that you're responsible for validating. As a university, the OIA places perhaps more responsibility on you as that validating partner for the continuing success of students. And that's it's possibly not a game changer, but it's probably going to give some pause for thought, isn't it, about some of these partnerships?
Well, yeah, I think what's interesting about this is we're talking about a private provider in the UK. Of course, you know, in my work in various universities, we're working with private providers in South Asia, Southeast Asia, where many more. And you could argue actually more risky because you're doing it at distance. But the answer to the question is, I think that's actually right. I think if you're got a validation agreement with a private public provider who gets into financial trouble in terms of seeing those students through on your awards, then I do think you have a responsibility. And in fact, anywhere where I've worked, we would take that very, very seriously, because as Selena's saying, it's really about, you know, it's about having a responsibility for their journey. I don't see anything. I think the trouble with this argument normally is because it gets dropped into a private public discussion. You know, and my view generally has been around a mixed economy is a good thing, mainly because internationally that's what I'm dealing with all the time. And lest we forget, a large number of our UK universities do similar arrangements with private providers offshore outside of the UK, and don't have any problem with that. That's part of their internationalization agenda. It's also the monies from that are going straight to their bottom line to allow them to invest in all sorts of things, including the research agendas they have. And that has to come with a responsibility. I have no problem with that.
I mean, Sina, one of the other things that jumped out was this question of redress, because I mean, you have to wonder if OIA is expecting lots of complaints this year, because I guess what they're saying is that, you know, it's legitimate. You know, if you've tried everything, you tried to live up to what you promised, but you've had to make a change, and you've sought consent. But at the end of the day, you know, the facts have changed, and I can imagine lots of examples of this in kind of the COVID crisis. It's okay as long as you've offered some redress, reasonable redress. I can't remember the exact language to students. You've got to wonder whether a lot of the complaints this year might be about whether, you know, sure, you know, we understand that you had to make changes, but that redress wasn't quite good enough.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is always the problem with the language of kind of reasonableness. Have you made reasonable efforts to communicate? Have you reasonable efforts to make some form of alternative arrangement? And I think, you know, that is a very, very subjective thing. And actually, one of the things this is brought out is it very much depends on your own individual circumstances, whether an institution's attempt to make some reasonable change is suitable for you. So the example in terms of GSM and the responsibilities of the validating provider was those students could have transferred to that university. However, it was too far away for many of the students who were based in London. So, you know, it might be okay if you're an 18-year-old and you've got, you know, sufficient funds that it doesn't matter where you study and you don't need to rely on a part-time job and you haven't got caring responsibilities. But obviously, there is a real diversity in students' experience and what they need to be successful at university. So I think there's that angle too in terms of the processes for complaints and indeed the standards of adjudicating around complaints, that it is still highly subjective in my view. And I think one of the things that if I was, you know, I don't know, at NUS or a kind of student facing body, I mean, I think this is an area that over the next few years really, really does need to be beefed up. And I think students will need far more external and independent advocacy.
Hello and welcome to Yes, But Does It Correlate? The podcast segment that is the only part of the higher education sector not currently reviewing admissions. There's always an underlying theme in Mickey Mouse course type stories that the growth in student numbers over recent years has been focused on subject areas with low entry requirements. So I've plotted the growth over 2 years in each top level subject area against the percentage of entrants with 3 A's or above at A level or the equivalent. So is it less demanding subject areas that are seeing the bulk of recent student number growth? Does it correlate?
It's an interesting question, and we're doing similar research within the University of Reading. I mean, I don't think it correlates in terms of where that growth is. Again, it's very difficult. I'm working in a research intensive university with a fairly high tariff. So what we're seeing is increased interest in programmes right across the board. So I mean, of course, quite often, you know, the government agenda is that the increase is all in the lower tariff, Mickey Mouse provision, sorry to use that phrase. I'm not sure that correlates.
I'm going to be honest and say I never really even understand the question when it comes to this game. But I'm going to say, having consulted with my dog, who's lying here behind me, that it correlates.
The answer is no. Not in a statistically significant way. R squared is about 0.2 for p being less than 0.05. But the trend that does exist is positive. Subject areas with larger proportions of well-qualified entrants actually appear to be growing faster. Data is from the most recent available HESA collections, and where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
And finally, I caught up with Jonathan Simons from Public First, to talk about the big reset at number 10, what it means, the personalities that are changing, and what that might mean for policy over the next few months.
Yeah, so a huge amount has changed. The most important thing that's changed is you may have noticed there was one or two small news articles about the fact that Dominic Cummings has now left number 10. He has left number 10 along with Lee Kane, who was the slightly lesser known director of communications. This is significant beyond parlor game politics. This is significant because Dominic Cummings in particular was a major driver of the Prime Minister's agenda, both in electoral terms but also in policy terms. And some of the issues he was very interested in were the higher education issue and the science issue in particular. So what has happened on the back of that, and indeed the reasons why he left, we should say allegedly to all of these things, but the reasons why he left and why Lee Kane left were because of a feeling that the general government approach towards public policy was not sufficiently bearing fruit, that they'd fallen out in part over personality, but also partly fallen out over the direction of travel. And so what we're seeing now is lots of discussion about the so-called reset of government policy. Now, it remains to be seen whether any of this actually does amount to a concrete shift or whether this is just different factions fighting for influence. But I think it is reasonably clear that the Prime Minister, assuming that we come out in 2021 with some form of a COVID vaccine, with some form of a Brexit deal, and things sort of revert back to normal, that the Prime Minister wants to take a different approach towards the remainder of this parliamentary term in the run-up to the 2024 election.
And so some of the characters you mentioned, Dominic Cummings. I think a lot of the research and science community is kind of hoping against hope he doesn't reappear as head of the ARPA. I've heard that one mentioned a few times. Lee Kane, as you say, is out. Who else is on their way out or expected to be out in this kind of reset?
So I think in terms of it is possible that there may be some subsequent shuffling around the more sort of junior and middle ranks of people. There again were lots of rumours flying around that, for example, David Frost, who's the Brexit negotiator, may be leaving. Certainly, in effect, one would hope his job is effectively done in a month or so's time. Anyway, there were discussions that other slightly more junior people in the number 10 team were going to be moving around. But I think the issue is not particularly who else may leave, in so much as where the power is going to lie. So the thing about number 10 is it is a feudal court. There is no org chart, or not an org chart that actually makes a difference. The only thing that matters are, to misquote Hamilton, that you need to be in the room where it happens, that you are somebody who has the ear of the Prime Minister, that you are somebody whose advice is listened to, whether that's written advice or verbal advice, that you are somebody who can reasonably claim to know what the Prime Minister thinks about things and in turn communicate that to the rest of the Whitehall. And if you have that, then you are in a position of huge power, regardless of your formal seniority. And at the moment, the discussion going on within number 10 is who has such power.
And as that relates to kind of policy, as it might be reset, there's a whole bunch of things related to higher education and education more broadly, isn't there? Because if policy is shifted perhaps towards some backbench MPs that Boris wants to keep on side, we've heard education mentioned as part of that effort to give them some kind of power back over decisions, having there been, you know, several months of disquiet over the coronavirus response. Do you think it's realistic that MPs might take more of a direct role in policy making as opposed to the policy unit, for example?
Yes. So there are. It has been briefed out that there will be this new MPs task force on education and skills, and there are three Tory MPs who've been named as potentially being part of it. Those are Jonathan Gullis, David Johnson, and Miriam Cates. Now, they are, in truth, three Tory MPs from quite a small group who are interested in education and skills. David Johnson used to run a social mobility charity before he came into Parliament. Miriam Cates was involved in education, and Jonathan Gullis, probably the best known of those three, used to be a teacher and indeed a teaching trade union rep, which is not a normal career path to being a Tory MP. I think, in truth, that group is a bit of a sinecure. It's a bit of a slightly glorified title you give to some MPs who are important in the parliamentary party. You keep them on board, you ask them to do some work, you promise to read what they've written, you probably even do read what they've written, but it's not going to have any formal power. I think the formal power will still reside principally within the policy unit, so Alison Wolfe remains in the policy unit. She is an interesting one because she only ever does 3 days a week. That's her contract. She's still a serving academic. And she, although she is a political appointee, she's not a political operator. She is, as listeners will know, a real higher education and skills expert. And she is in number 10 to do higher education and skills policy. And she remains very exercised with delivering the skills white paper, FE white paper, HE strategy document, whatever combination we are expecting over the next few months. And so she will continue to be there and she will continue to deliver that. There are various other people in number 10 who continue to have an interest in education policy. Munira Mirza, whose star is on the rise and is being tipped as potentially being the new chief of staff, has got a strong interest in education policy. And there are various other people in number 10 as well that keep an interest in it. So I think safe to say that number 10 are still going to hold education policy reasonably tightly. Having said that, Ian Mansfield within the DfE is also a major, major player here, and he will continue to be so. And if anything, his position has probably been strengthened merely by the fact that he's still there whilst other people have left. The question for that will be is if there is a reshuffle in the new year, will Ian leave, as special advisors often do leave when their ministers leave? I'd expect there to be quite a big ministerial reshuffle in the DfE. If that happens, will Ian leave? Does that happen before the various strategy documents are published? We don't know. But obviously, that's the big issue with departmental special advisors, is they're more reliant on their ministers than number 10 are.
The other name that we've not mentioned is Neil O'Brien, who's been talked about as kind of head of a new policy board out of Number 10. And he's very much a university skeptic, I think it's fair to say.
Yes, that's right. And actually, you're quite right. Neil is a very, very important part of this puzzle. So the suggestion is that they are going to have a policy board, as well as a policy unit, and as well as policy task forces. And Neil is tipped as the chair of that. Now, I should say, with the caveat that I know Neil reasonably well and have worked with him in the past, I think he's excellent. I think he's an outstanding appointment. He is a thinker, as they say, and he is somebody that thinks very deeply about public policy. You are right, though, and you know, this is not particularly inside gossip. You can read what he's written many, many times on the topic of universities, both under his own name, but also through the Onward think tank, which he co-set up with Will Tanner, of course, again, another former Number 10 special advisor under Theresa May, and the what we might call the Onward view of the world as relates to higher education policy is quite sceptical. So they've done a lot of work on low-value education, for example. They are very cautious about international students, particularly those that come from China. Onward is definitely on the China sceptic wing of the Conservative Party, and that obviously has big implications for HE. They've done quite a lot of stuff around universities closing off avenues for bright kids from deprived backgrounds, and indeed Neil wrote a piece for Conservative Home a few days ago, which was essentially his job ad for this, his job application for this role, and admittedly it was only a couple of sentences, and there's always a danger of overpassing these, but he specifically talks about education and references the big higher education debate that has to be happened, which is more or less, do we continue as we are, or do we, by we meaning the government, make a big move on low-value courses and more people doing technical education and fewer people doing traditional level six.
And what's your view about whether there will really be the headspace or the bandwidth or the political capital to actually tackle that? So this is an agenda that's now been talked about, hasn't it, for several years by this government and its predecessors. But we've seen very little actual meat on the bones when it comes to policy. I mean, it's quite a lot of aggro, isn't it? Because you'd be taking on, not only taking on universities, but taking on all their allies in the Lords, and plenty of Tory MPs and members of the people in the party who, like David Willetts, I'm thinking of, like Joe Johnson, you know, who are influential in their own right and would push back strongly against that agenda.
Yeah, you're completely right. So I think the first thing to say is that there are multiple strains of thought within the Conservative Party as relates to higher education, and we can discern some of those. There is the Onward wing, as we may call it. There's the, I suppose, what we could call the post-liberal wing, the Goodhart wing, although David Goodhart himself is not obviously a Tory MP or even a Tory member. There is, I suppose, what you could call the Willetts or the Willettsian wing, which is probably the most supportive of the fairly traditional small L liberal view towards higher education, and there are infinite variants and currents in between that. I suppose so. Yes, you're completely right. It's not a done deal that if they wanted to do something like that, the Tory party, particularly in the Lords, would wave it through. And there's obviously a lot of Lords who have been vice chancellors as well. I think the bigger question for me on this agenda, the bigger question is twofold for me. The first is, for all the noise that the government has been making about free speech, for example, and about culture wars in the last year, is that a substitute for activity, or is it actually foregrounding actual things they want to change? Because it is possible that the only strategy is to create sound and fury and to not actually have any intention to do anything about it, but you achieve your electoral gain by shouting loudly about people you don't like and your voters don't like. If that is the case, you don't have to do anything else. You can continue to shout about them. On the other hand, the reset narrative seems to suggest that they may dial down the culture war. Then the question is, do you dial it down and let universities get on? Or do you dial it down and actually start to do policy? And if you're Neil O'Brien, who is not a natural cultural warrior, but is a deep policy thinker, you may conclude that actually you want to seek change more quietly, but potentially more effectively. And so I think some of the straws in the wind on this are things like the OFS consultation on continuation rates, on graduate employment, some of the work that Universities UK have now kicked off on low value. If I were wanting, in my exalted position as head of the new PM's policy board, to actually make things happen, it would be a consistent strategy for me to dial down the shouting at student unions, but dial up things that I may seek to do via legislation, via the response to the Augur review, via the funding controls that sit within me, via the regulatory power of the OFS. That is actually, in truth, how you achieve much more significant change, or at least threaten that change such that the universities do what you want them to do anyway.
Fascinating. And finally, just on the reshuffle, which we expect in the new year, don't we? I mean, it's almost received wisdom that Gavin Williamson, Education Secretary, is likely to be out in that. The Times caused a minor panic, I think, in the education Twitter a few days ago when it suggested Michael Gove might be making a return. Do you think that's likely?
I think that is highly unlikely. Much as on a personal level I might enjoy it immensely. I think that it is highly unlikely. I suspect Michael has done his time in education for good or for ill, and people have very strong views as to which of those it was. I think that we will see quite a significant shift in personnel, and I think we may see of the five ministers in DfE, leaving alone Baroness Berridge in the Lords, we could conceivably see all four of the other ministers move. So that includes Michelle Donnellan and Gillian Keegan. Traditionally, junior ministers don't stay around for that long. I think the question for them will be, have the big pieces of white papery, which are sitting on Department for Education servers at the moment, do they get out under this set of ministers or not? So we have the spending review on the 25th of November. That is in some senses going to be a bit of a damp squib because it is only a one-year settlement, so we're not going to see huge changes to higher education funding next week. We have, we believe, a skills white paper, some sort of HE strategy document, and some sort of formal auger response. At least two of those may be combined into the same document. We're now not expecting those until January, February next year. When might the government do a reshuffle? I actually would be surprised if it was that early next year. They need to get the Brexit deal done, assuming that they do want to do a deal. They are now rumours that there is going to be an adjustment period, which actually takes us slightly into the new year because they're just running out of time to get it ratified. So let's assume that January is taken up with getting all that done. They will almost certainly want to wait until the vaccine, touch wood, starts to come through and comes on stream. That takes us through to about March. We've got the budget due in March. Again, if you're Rishi Sunak, you're probably wanting to make a bold statement. I would expect we'd see a reshuffle round and about March time. That probably means there is time to push out these HE documents under the old regime, and that would be my best guess as to what we'll see.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Apple Podcasts or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email at team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Selena, Paul, Jonathan and everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. Until next week, stay safe.